but just because you do. The unjustifiable things, the illogical things, the things that are genuinely unexplainable, that's where the magic is. The right stuff always just is. It's the illusions and fears and things we force that have to be justified and made sense of in our minds. If you are making a choice that you can only feel good about when you back up with a list of because, you're not really listening to what you want. This is probably the biggest secret and most important fact of all. If your little inner voice were telling you that you weren't interested or you were on the wrong path, it wouldn't say anything at all. You'd just let it go. Consider the people you aren't romantically interested in, the career paths you know don't call you. Do you sit around and belabor whether or not they're right? Nope, you don't. You just don't acknowledge them at all. The opposite of love is indifference, eh? There's no difference between the things that pain you and the things that please you. They are both intended to teach you something. You have brought them into your experience because you want to learn from them. Illusions have to be justified. Half-truths have to be made sense of. The genuine things, the best things, the most right things truly just are. If it's in your life, there's something to be learned from it. The process of unlearning the reasons to justify the illusions is how you reacquaint yourself with the voice that doesn't use words. It's ultimately why you choose to get lost in the first place. 45. Experiences we don't have English words for yet. 1. When sunlight shines through the trees, the interplay between light and leaves. 2. When you're with your friends and decide who is who in a show or movie you all watch and then laugh hysterically about how them that character is behaving. The running joke that develops around you characterizing the members of your social circle based on some cultural stencil. Think Sex and the City. 3. The feeling of your skin on someone else's. 4. The temporary, beautiful high of deciding you're going to change your life in some aesthetic, easy way. The conviction that this will change anything or everything else. 5. The inability to grasp the fact that we can't grasp what we don't know yet. 6. Hearing something a dozen times and then finally understanding what it means only when it becomes the answer to a problem you have. 7. When physical human age has no bearing on connectedness, intelligence, ability. 8. The parenting style that consists of trying to punish, embarrass, scold, and oppress children into being functional, kind, successful members of society. 9. Wanting to have a spiritual sexual experience with someone. Sex that is more than just a grinding race to orgasm. 10. The mental preparation that occurs before you step into a social situation in which you have to play a role for the sake of maintaining a relationship, i.e., rehearsing your conversations with yourself by yourself. 11. The feeling of absolute peacefulness right before you fall asleep. 12. Not just assuming we know what other people are thinking and feeling, but acting on that knowing, judging them for that knowing, and really in a lot of ways capping off their potential with what we think we know of them. 13. The feeling of lightness in your whole body. 14. The love you know has an expiration date. 15. The love you know you're eventually meant for. 16. People who are funny without being mean. 17. people who are deep without being negative. 18. The frustration you feel when somebody is mad or upset over completely false things that they've made up in their mind, a complete lack of understanding on a situation. 19. The random, weird, scary, embarrassing thoughts that cross your mind and sometimes freak you out that you think you're alone in having because everybody else is scared and embarrassed by them too. 20. The art of trying to figure out someone's intentions by piecing together a bunch of random bits of evidence. 21. The kind of stuck feeling of knowing something isn't quite right, but you're not yet aware of what the alternative would be. 22. The comfort that comes with arriving at small, safe conclusions now and again. 23. The real peace of dissolving those illusions. 24. The feeling of realizing that your purpose won't usually feel like a purpose, as you have to do the work regardless, and so the whole act of finding it was just a mechanism of the ego in the first place. 25. How we define periods of our lives and personal development beyond years or grades or segments of schooling. 26. The space between raindrops. 27. A course of study that teaches you the art of the non-traditionally academic things that take up the majority of our lives. Love, relationships, doubt, faith, parenting, work, friendship, self-image, etc. 28. Being in love with someone who you only used to know, and at some level still feel as though you do. 29. The happy, tired feeling you get after you eat a big meal. 30. The sensation of looking back on something far more fondly than when it was actually happening. The idea that maybe this kind of enjoyment is not to be fought or transcended, but just appreciated for what it is. 31. The feeling of feeling a feeling. 32. A person or thing that also feels like home, a non-house home. 33. The idea that is, all is as it should be. 46. How to become your own worst enemy without ever realizing it. Let yourself be governed by the illusion of separateness. Believe that you're always in competition with those around you, that you are only as good as you are better than someone else. Believe your conditioning is the only one, the right one. Drown your desire for connection by manically scrolling through feed after feed, day after day. Live your life waiting, waiting, waiting for someone else to make you feel love. Put it all in their hands. Condemn them when they don't perform. Believe you're not enough on your own, that there's something in this world that will save you and can and should. Believe that marriage licenses mean love, job titles success, religion, goodness, money, contentment. Trust fully in the powers that be. Let them teach you how to let your fear control you. Do not let yourself feel anything other than what other people say it's okay to feel. If your life looks good from the outside, don't take the liberty to say it doesn't feel good on the inside. Act only in accordance with what will make sense to other people. Make the most important facet of your existence being palatable to anyone and everyone else. Trick yourself into thinking that kind of numb safety is happiness. Hate yourself for still caring about the person you aren't supposed to care about anymore. Shame yourself until you're completely suppressing everything you feel. Spend days and months and years checking their status updates and new pictures in search of something, anything that justifies the feelings you just want to kill off. Tie yourself in mental knots, trying to get your head and heart to coexist. Make caring a bad thing. Make loving worse. Assume that the line between good and bad runs between religions, or races, or creeds, or nations, rather than in each human heart. Disregard our universal capacity to drown in our denseness. Fail to recognize the sameness and beauty in the people you've condemned, because they were born with genetics or practices or perceptions that are different than yours, because they were conditioned the opposite way to which you were. Never realize that you were conditioned at all. Believe that you are your thoughts, that you are your emotions, rather than the being observing those things. Never realize the constant stream of conversation you hold with yourself. Never realize that 2/3 of the statements you make and ideas you have are not organically yours. Disregard that they don't lead you to contentment or kindness or hope, and accept them anyway. Pick and choose the people to whom you afford humanness. Decide who is worthy and not. Sift through the traits and habits of others. Categorize them into what's acceptable and not. Don't let someone be worthy of love and respect just because they are alive. Doing this will ensure you never give the same kindness to yourself. Be your worst enemy so nobody else can be. Assume the worst so nobody can surprise you with it. Call it being realistic. Accept the life someone else thinks you deserve. Don't believe that change is real. Don't believe in anything other than what you can immediately sense and see. Suffocate the chance of possibility. Sustain yourself on temporary highs, the kind that come from other people and their attention. Let your past experiences quantify your self-hatred. Create your past in your present. Let other people wash away the good parts of you. Call this being strong. Settle because you are afraid to choose. Call this being smart. Fight others so you don't have to face yourself. Resist and reject until it seems like everyone and everything is seeping under your skin and torturing you. Never realize your mind does the wielding. Never realize that bit by bit, you created the life you never really wanted with the pieces you never really chose. 47. If we saw souls instead of bodies. If we could see souls instead of bodies, what would be beautiful? What is the first thing people would know about you? What would you be most afraid of them seeing? Who would you impress? Who would you love? What would you adjust as you walked past the mirror? What kind of work would you be in? What would your goals be? How would you strive to be better if what you collected in the bank or put on your body or attached next to your name on a business card no longer affected what people saw? Would you spend your time in gyms and stores or in libraries and temples? Who would you let yourself fall in love with? What would your type be? Tall, dark, and handsome, or creative, kind, and self-aware? Whom would we idolize and what? How much of our governing body would be fit to lead? Whom would we make famous? Whom would we celebrate? Would we restructure our value system to prioritize the things that bring us true peace and desire, not just better than the norm? What would we do with all that money if we weren't spending it on decorating and changing and convincing everybody else that we are a way we really aren't? How would we define success? As who gathers the most shit around their souls? Or who's transformed the most and shines the brightest? What would it be like if our priority was to just become lightness? What kindness and joy and healing and rawness would come of the journey there? What would happen if we could see people not as bad, but as blocked? If we could see the ways they've packed away their pain, or how they hold a belief that keeps them away from being kind to others, how they are unaware that those issues even exist? What if we weren't afraid of the ways people are different than us? What would happen if we realized our bodies never wanted anything more than to feel connected and acted out on nothing more than their false ideas of being separate, different, exiled, the odd one out, the almost but not good enough? What would happen if we embraced our desire to play out and finagle with our individualism, but eventually returned to the knowing that we are all just energy fields? And where would we be if we realized that we were all from the same one? What would happen if we realized we really weren't that different at all? 48. 16 reasons why you still don't have the love you want. 1. You want someone else to do the work of unearthing, creating, activating, and then convincing you of the love in your life. You want someone else to do what you were taught that you couldn't do for yourself. Every time you think, wish, imagine, or hope for someone else to give you something, dream of the day when they will, belabor and obsess over why they aren't, realize that thing is what you are not giving yourself. 2. Historically, it has not looked the way you thought it would, and that's because it never looks the way we think it will or comes the way we think it should. When we hold an idea of what love should look like, we attach to something that often just quells an insecurity, saves us from a reality, or helps us prove ourselves to someone else. Love never looks the way we think it will, because it's not supposed to look any certain way. Because the look of it won't actually give us the experience of it. But the pursuit of that will distract us from actually finding something genuine. 3. You think that love is just a good feeling, when love is really a consistent state of being in communion with body, mind, and soul. It is a daily commitment to learn what it means to love someone else in small, practical, mindful ways. You can be more or less attracted to someone, more or less compatible, but choosing to love and appreciate someone regardless of those variables is a constant that you can choose, and it's the belief that you can't because love must give you what you cannot give yourself that leads to so many breakups, divorces, etc. 4. You are unaware of the fact that love is nothing but an enhancement. It magnifies and brings clarity to whatever is most present in your life. So if the things that are most present are self-doubt, lostness, insecurity, etc., you will only have more and more of that. Love is not your life. It is the avenue through which you share your life, and more palpably, see yourself. 5. You believe that love will blossom when the circumstances are correct, as though you must place two reactive chemicals together and assume that an instantaneous physical/emotional response should equate to lifelong, sincere love. Hormones are reactive. Expectations are reactive. Love is cultivated from and because of those things, but more effectively, because of a mutual appreciation and respect for one another. 6. You are caught up in trying to make yourself objectively appealing to the opposite, or same sex, as opposed to really finding who you are, and then attracting someone who appreciates that person too. I am so saddened by how many young girls, and boys for that matter, are instructed to present themselves a certain way because that's just what's attractive. It's so silly to think generalizing what every person likes is helpful, because more insidiously, it keeps you trapped in avoidance of your true self, as you assume that person isn't good enough to elicit the approval of the masses. And then we sit around crying and cursing the stars over why we can't find somebody who loves us for who we really are. 7. You aren't clear on your intentions about what you want, and that's because you're still trying to edit and enhance them to appease, impress, or elicit someone else's approval. In other words, You can't be honest about what you want because you aren't comfortable with the truth of who you are. So long as you are functioning from that mindset, you are filtering your life, and whether or not you see the love in it, through how well it fits the image. 8. You blame others because you don't realize that every relationship you have is with yourself. Love does not suck. People do not suck. You suck. Relationships are the ultimate teaching tools, the most intense healing opportunities, the most explosively beautiful chances for us to really see what is unresolved within us. You run into the same problems. You find the same faults, the same relationships, the same pain, because it is all in you. 9. Likewise, you do not realize that negative emotions are calls to heal, not to change or drown or ignore because you don't want to feel bad anymore. Our feelings are how we communicate with ourselves. Healing is essentially reopening to seeing good, to being hopeful, sustaining, and then creating more love. Our negative emotions are not signals of what other people are doing wrong. They are meant to show us how we are misnavigating, misunderstanding, or being controlled by past experiences and fear-based beliefs. 10. You don't know how to use your heart and mind in tandem, the heart as the map and the mind as the compass. We're given two opposing sets of commandments. Follow your heart regardless of logic, and don't do anything stupid and illogical when it comes to who you choose to share your life with. The reality is that so long as you are polarized in the utilization of the most important guiding tools you have, or worse, you don't realize you have them, you will be lost as hell. That's a technical term, by the way. A quick cheat sheet for you. The heart will tell you what. The mind will tell you how. Let them stay in their corners of expertise. 11. You have yet to honor the child inside you. If you want to know who you really are, imagine speaking to yourself as a child. What would you say and do to make them feel happy? That expression is reflective of what you really need to give yourself and is very, very helpful for people who are seeking love. Because learning to love yourself is, as odd as it may sound, learning to honor, respect, love, and acknowledge the child in you, or in other words, your most essential self. 12. You want love to change your life. You want it to provide for you what you think you cannot give yourself. Stability, security, hope, happiness. So long as you function on this belief, you place love as being something that is outside of you, when the reality is that you cannot see, create, or experience on the outside what you are not already on the inside. Speaking of. 13. You don't realize that what you love most about others is what you love most about yourself. The more you are open to your own joy, the more you appreciate others. The more you are healed of your own anxiety, the less you have to cast blame and try to fight others into fixing you. Loving someone else comes down to being able to see what you appreciate about them, as it is similar to what you appreciate about yourself. 14. You not only think that somebody else is responsible for fixing you, but that there is something wrong with them if they don't. And so you want to change, fix, or condemn them for how they've wronged you. You want to blame them for not being good enough. You want to impose on them a whole lot of what you're really feeling about yourself. 15. You've forgotten kindness, when kindness is the fabric of love. I don't think there are people crueler to one another more than people who really, really love each other. They see so much of themselves in one another that they simply cannot stand it, and retaliate in all the same ways they are rejecting themselves. The foundation of a happy relationship, and life really, is unconditional kindness. It's synonymous with love, and maybe even more effective, because it shows you the action as opposed to the feeling or expectation. 16. You are looking for the answer outside of the question. For the 10th time, say it with me now. The love you really want is your own. What you're seeking in someone else is what you aren't giving to yourself. What angers you is what you aren't accepting and healing. What gives you joy and hope is what you already have within you. Finding a relationship to be that great enhancer, to have someone to share everything with, begins with you. It's as though we were taught to love ourselves first, without ever being told that loving yourself is giving yourself what you want someone else to. 49. How to actually change your life this year. People want to change their lives. They want to change their relationships, their bodies, their income, their brokerage accounts, their statuses, their homes. It's so easy to identify what's wrong on the outside and blame it for the feelings on the inside. Never is this so painfully clear as when the calendars reset and we think we're offered a fresh slate and blank page. It's easy to think a different year is a different life away. But we carry ourselves and our baggage and our energies and our hang-ups and insecurities and hopes and mindsets into that glimmering, hopeful, fresh start, blank page, new life. Our resolutions don't stick because you can't change the outside and expect a different inside. People want to change their lives. They want to change other people's lives, too. They want to change the injustices they see. They want to change the whole damn world. But they do not want to change themselves. Not their image. Not their appearance. Not their worldly success. Themselves. Which is, as it turns out, the one thing they can change. The one thing that must change first. We walk around with the cripplingly false idea that we must adjust how things are, as opposed to adjusting how we are and how we see them. This world might as well be a damn hall of mirrors. Rather than trying to break them all to distort and rearrange how you see the image, you have to let go of the idea that your image is all that exists. The things that torture us and the negative patterns that follow us and the reason we have to keep making the same resolutions year after year is that we are not making the shift. We are trying to shift other things. And the most hilariously, wonderfully, sadly unknown part of this is that when you do so, you end up with what you set out to achieve in the first place. The love and contentment and success. Only this time, your worth doesn't depend on it. You aren't a failure if you lose it one day. This all stems from self. 'Tis not the mountain man conquers, but himself. So, here is what you need to know. Whenever there is a problem in your life, there is a problem with how you are thinking, reacting, or responding. Whatever you feel you are not receiving is a direct reflection of what you are not giving. Whatever you are angered by is what you aren't willing to see in yourself. So where you feel you are lacking, you must give. Where there is tension, you must unpack. If you want more recognition, recognize others. If you want love, be more loving. Give exactly what you want to get. If you want to let go of something, build something new. If you don't understand, ask. If you don't like something, say so. If you want to change, start small. If you want something, ask for it. If you love someone, tell them. If you want to attract something, become it. If you enjoy something, let yourself feel it. If you do anything compulsively, ask yourself why. Stop trying to curb your spending or change your diet or avoid that one person or lash out at innocent people you love. Look for the cause of the feeling, not just the feeling itself, and you'll fix the problem for good. If you miss somebody, call them. It is silly to suffer in silence. It is noble and humbling to tell someone that they matter to you, regardless of whether or not you matter to them. If your life is missing something you cannot place back into it, restructure. You will get nowhere dismantling the pieces with nothing to take their place. You'll end up reassembling the parts of the old life you're trying to do away with. Step away and build anew. Anything new. You cannot expect to carry on with the same life you had without someone and not have that gaping hole torture you. Give yourself permission to build something beautiful. Something true. If you want to be understood, explain. There is nothing we need more than people who are willing to kindly, gently, wholly, patiently explain to others. If you want to be happy, choose it. Choose to be consciously, consistently grateful for something. Choose to immerse yourself in something beautiful and peaceful and joyous. If you can't choose this, choose to start working on figuring out what blocks you, be it health or circumstance or mindset. Get help. Ask for it. Saying you can't choose is giving up for good. Don't do that. Choose change. Your routine, your job, your city, your habits, your mindset. Never sit and fester in frustration. It does not matter whether or not you're in the absolute worst-case scenario. Complaining, worrying, or being negative will never help. Anything. At all. Ever. Everything you do, see, and feel is a reflection of not who you are, but how you are. You create what you believe. You see what you want. You'll have what you give. 50. How we lose our minds to other people's gods. People allow accountants to map the blueprints of their lives. Not their essential desires, their favorite philosophers, the ideas that induce visceral reactions and become beliefs. These things don't provide a measure of what it takes to survive, a gauge on the things that have been pressed on us to seem enjoyable, so they are considered secondary. An accountant can tell you how you can live and where, what opportunities will be open and not, how comfortably you can buy holiday gifts and fund your child's education. We gauge our quality of life not by what or how much we do, but how we appear and what we earn from that doing. We're not quite at fault for this. Present-day monoculture, the governing pattern, the master narrative, the beliefs we accept without ever having consciously accepted them, tells us that if wealth and attractiveness and worldly possessions don't make us feel high and alive, we just don't have enough of them. It makes sense on an initial level, but as anybody can tell you, acquiring another zero at the end of the balance on your bank statement, or a variety of new things that really just represent your perceived worth or lack thereof, only changes how much you have surrounding you, not how deeply or sincerely you can appreciate them, feel them, enjoy them, want them, be happy because of them. If it takes more than the slightest bit of personal experience to attest to this, pluck from the endless proverbial pile of research. External acquisition does not yield internal contentment. And yet we trek on. We are still enslaved to the things we are taught are ultimate goods. We justify our faith in the system by flawed and influenced logic. We continue to believe that something external can change our internal ability to be aware, to appreciate, to live, to feel. Once we are initially convinced that not just money, but an idea of morality, education, and yes, general wealth, parlay into contentment, we become rats on a spinning wheel, and we'll spend the rest of our lives there if we aren't careful. If you've never heard of it before, we all seem to be suffering from a sort of Diderot effect. Denis Diderot was a philosopher during the Enlightenment, author of the fictional essay, Regrets on Parting with My Old Dressing Gown. As the story goes, he lived a very simple life and was happy until a friend gave him a gift, a gorgeous scarlet dressing gown. The more he wore his gown around his small apartment, the more the simplicity of his life seemed out of place. He then desired new furnishings, as one with a dressing gown as beautiful as his shouldn't be living in a lowly home. He then wanted to replace his other clothes, his wall hangings, and so on. He wound up in debt and toiling his life away, trying to maintain the glamour of his surroundings, an elusive, endless task. Because modern daily life keeps us consistently dipping our toes and dousing our senses in ads and success stories that are born of luxury and married to materialism, it is almost impossible to take a step back and see the system objectively. So most don't. I don't know about you, but I have never seen a god so worshipped and adored as a dollar bill. Never so much faith put into systems designed to maintain power and serve the ego. The most insidiously effective governors are the ones that do not tell you they are controlling you, and they are the ones you have programmed your need to keep running on the wheel, staring at the illusory screen, thinking you're heading to that end goal. Behind the cage, what you cannot see is that the wheel you are running on endlessly powers their monopoly. And because of this predisposed collective mindset that is very evidently not serving us, we believe in a variety of goods. Be educated. Be a good person. Have money. Be attractive. Work out. Have a great job. Buy a house. And onward. It ignites the interest of our senses, our base instincts, our egoic selves. But how often do we question the good that has been imposed on us? How often do we really stop and question how much faith we have in a system that has us convinced our natural state, our simple lives, our inner joys, are not good enough? The next time you make a choice because you are trying to be a good person, I implore you to consider that those who commit suicide terrorism believe they are being good people, martyrs for their God. The next time you equate a degree to an education, consider the state of really any aspect of our society. We are absolutely starved for knowledge, and yet the premium on education these days seems to be limitless. There is no amount of debt, disinterest, or complete disregard for actual learning that will stand in the way of people getting degrees and believing their education is complete for their lifetime. I often look around at older people and wonder how we've confused respecting your elders with allowing them to believe it's okay to stop learning after age 23 and let them sit and fester in the prejudices of the generation in which they were raised. So we're handing out empty degrees like candy, degrees that promise success at a steep, suffocating cost and placating bias and prejudice with a laugh and sigh, because that's what we're instructed is right. I'm not saying there's no value in education. I'm saying it's the only thing of real value, and we're falling cripplingly short of actually giving that to the masses. I dream of a day that college grads leave school not believing that their education is only the leg power to latch themselves on a corporate treadmill for the better parts of their lives, but rather something that has given them the context, the history, the perspective, and the opportunity to learn what makes them tick and flow, how to question everything and discuss anything objectively, to choose the life they want, not adhere to the life that was chosen for them. Neither Hobbes, nor Plato, nor Spinoza, nor Hume, nor Locke, nor Nietzsche, nor Jobs, nor Wintour, nor Descartes, nor Beethoven, nor Zuckerberg, nor Lincoln, nor Rockefeller, nor Edison, nor Disney, nor countless other game-changing, culture-shifting, brilliant-minded individuals were academics. The pattern is enough of a trend to make you wonder whether or not a component of their exceptional success was that they were never conditioned to believe one thing was good. Their ideas were never edited or tailored to the liking of someone else's. They never had to quell their real opinions in lieu of a grade, and they never compiled other people's ideas for years and called it research. In Plato's The Republic, he tells an oft-cited allegory of men chained together in a cave, with their backs to a flame, believing that the masterfully crafted shadows that those behind them were holding up were reality. Seeing that light, metaphorically or not, is the truest education, mostly because we need not lay eyes on it to understand it. We need only piece together the illusions we perceive to make sense of what is behind us. And really, at the end of the day, it is not our own illusions that are dangerous. It's other people's. Especially when we accept them not only as integral, unmoving parts of our ultimately dissatisfying lives, but when we believe them to be good, unquestioningly, unfailingly. Nobody ever gave someone permission to be enlightened. No new line of thinking or creative genius was born of what was already acceptable. We associate acceptable with good, when really acceptable is mostly staying within the lines someone else uses to control you by, for better and for worse. Our lives are not measured by other people's gods, not their dollars or illusions or business plans, not their beauty standards or declarations of what's right and wrong and good and bad and whom we should be on any given day. It seems the task of the generation, century maybe, will be radically accepting ourselves in a society that feeds on the opposite. Seeing illusions for what they are, even, and maybe especially when they are other people's. Making kindness cool and humility humor. Forgiving the way things are, knowing the only way to reinvent anything is not to destroy what's present, but to create a new, more efficient model, one that renders the other obsolete. 51. How you fall out of love with the idea of someone. There are two ways things turn out. You lose a thing, you replace it with something else, it's better than what you lost, you're happy. You lose a thing, it doesn't disappear when it's replaced. Not having it becomes as much of a presence as having it was. You're told the things you can't forget about are meant to be in your mind. The simple aftermath of having loved somebody so deeply. You hold on to a someone and someday that was supposed to be yours. We are told to believe that not being able to let go of the things we lose does nothing but prove how much we loved them in the first place. And I don't think this is true. Living with a ghost, crafting an idea that you need to hold on to fill a space or insecurity with, is using the idea of someone to fix something about yourself. We love heartbreak. And we love putting it on ourselves. We're more nostalgic for things that never happened than we are grateful and present in the things that are. We start missing things we never had, that we just created in our minds in this false, ultra-reality. The things that are easily replaced are usually the ones that you haven't attached existential meaning to. That is to say, they're the things you don't rely on to give you a sense of self. The things that don't leave your head are not the ones that show you what's meant to be. They're the things that show you what you're still not okay with on your own. You know what unconditional love is? Unconditional love is loving someone even if they don't unconditionally love you in return. That's affection without pretense. That's what we claim we're after, and yet we can barely grasp the idea. Most people we enjoy because they're contact highs. The idea of types and standards are proof that we're just looking for somebody to play a role. Heartbreak is the aftermath of when somebody steps out of the very specific notion you had of them. Suddenly, they're not doing what you think they should be doing, and so they are wrong. The inability to detach is holding on to the fact that the package looked so perfect. The pieces seem to fit, and yet... but still... Being in love with somebody that you only used to know is like falling in love with a book, which sounds like a dumb example, but people really do fall in love with them. The point is, You can love it all you want, but it's a story that runs parallel to yours. At the end of the day, it's static. It's memory. It's a sentence, and you can't change it. It ends how it ends. It says what it says. A friend once told me that the secret to finding love was not to actually look for it, but to heal the things that were preventing you from seeing and receiving it. I think the biggest one of all is, what will having this love fix? What will having this person next to me make me feel better about? What do I need them to tell me? What do I need them to prove? Who do I need them to look great in front of? What purpose do they serve for my ego? This is true of many things, not just of love. We confuse genuine affection and real love with the light, happy, free feeling we experience for a few seconds, days, months, when we have fed our egos. That's why it doesn't last. That's why we hold on to ideas of things that were and things we need to be. The idea of someone saves something about ourselves. And the more we hold on to those fragments of a person, those soundbite dreams that distract us from the moment, we end up with a few distilled memories that we've turned into life-sustaining hopes, and we piece it all together and place it on the shoulders of the person who we thought loved us enough to make us love ourselves. And if you're not careful, that person will become a part of you. They will become the good part, the whole part, the love of your life. 52. Why we subconsciously love to create problems for ourselves. I think most people could objectively look at their lives and see how frequently the problems they had were of their own making, their suffering self-inflicted. We absolutely love to make problems for ourselves, and we do it all the time. We worry needlessly. We choose immobility. We resist acceptance. We externalize our power. We surrender our ability to choose, when really it's up to us to decide how we react, when we change, what we entertain our minds with. It's yet another symptom of our own masochism to say that we don't have a choice in the matter. And we do it because we love it. There's something fun in making problems for ourselves. There is something we keep returning to, whether it be because we feel we deserve it, that it gives our lives meaning, that it gives us human credibility for having been through something, anything. We want to create our own problems. Because when we are the ones who make them, we are the ones who can overcome them. It seems we almost stage accomplishments in our minds. We subconsciously know that we're going to get through it, but we choose to entertain the suffering, only to feel that sense of, ah, I've done something. I've proven my own strength. We make things difficult, so they seem warranted of feeling good when they aren't anymore. The more we suffer, the more something is worthwhile. We craft our victories subconsciously. We know there's no point in fretting or worrying about anything. If something can be solved, solve it. If it cannot, worrying and fretting will not suddenly change that. In either scenario, it is pointless, needless noise. But the point is that we like worrying and fretting. If we didn't like it so much, we probably wouldn't do it incessantly. It feeds some human part of us that modernization has robbed us of. What are we surviving? What is the point? Why? Well, because when everything has an answer, what is there to do? If everything has a solution, what is there to consider, or work toward, or feel excited about accomplishing? Or rather, really, why do we need to work towards something? Why do we need to feel excited about accomplishments, rather than what we already have? What exists within us that is so unsettled that we cannot be at peace? I think we create our own problems to address the things we know would otherwise become issues outside of our control. We make them in ways that allow us to heal, address, fix, cope, and acknowledge whatever we want to get to before some other heartbreaking, external circumstance does it for us. We create our own problems in the scope of knowing we eventually have the solutions, so we can safely, albeit painfully, deal with them. So really, it's not a matter of not making issues for ourselves, but being aware enough to understand what they are, and that we're asking ourselves to heal them. 53. Why does a soul want a body? Yesterday, I took a shortcut while walking home and ended up crossing through a small graveyard in the back of a city church. I stopped and I looked at the names and the dates and the veterans and the three-year-olds and loving wives and fathers and sisters and husbands, the immortalized bits of what their lives were summed up to be, and I thought to myself, why would a soul want a body? What can a body do that a soul can't? Why would it want an impermanent, gross, heavy, hurting thing? I was standing in front of a husband and wife that died in the late 1800s. I looked at their final resting places, a few inches away from one another, and realized, a soul can't touch. Assuming the idea that a soul is an energy field, that our spirits do indeed exceed the speck of life our bodies provide in the span of infinity, a soul can't touch. It can't see the light. It is the light. It doesn't know the need for human skin. It can't run its fingers over someone else's hand and neck and back, and it can't feel crippling desire and ecstatic passion. Those are symptoms of a madness we call love, but it's human love. It's often shallow and wild and manic, and the equivalent of smoking crack cocaine. It melts into an appreciation of something deeper, or it burns brightly, and then it goes out. Souls can't experience a beginning or an end, nor an array and spectrum of emotions. They can't be surprised because they were never confused or unknowing. They don't know physical emotional warmth, or what it's like to hold and kiss a new baby on the forehead, or the jilt you get in your chest when you smell the person you love. Your soul can't feel the cadence of reading your favorite book, or the sensation when your mind puts someone else's story into your life, or how your fingers flip through the broken binding for the trillionth time, and how lovely that book smell is, especially when it's your favorite one. It doesn't know that crisp and comforting coolness of fall, or the heat of the sun on your back in the summer. It doesn't know that deep feeling you get when you spread your fingers out and run your hand through water. It can't wear your favorite t-shirt, or eat cookie dough, or sweat, or breathe, or cry, or dance. It doesn't know the lifetime comfort of your mother, or your lover wrapping their arm around you matter-of-factly. A body is responsible for the most amazing part of anything, physically finding or creating. Once we have something, we don't want it anymore. What we really want is to make and fight and become. A soul doesn't have to pay the bills or go food shopping or cook dinner or schedule a checkup or do the dishes or make plans for Friday to keep up with a relationship. It doesn't have to take hot baths to relax or organize the house or run errands or take walks to think. A body can learn. A body can feel the magic of realization. It can piece the pieces together and understand. It can get lost so it can be found. It can suffer so it can heal. What if the series of rote tasks we want our lives to be better than aren't better than us at all? What if they're what we're scheduled to do? What if there is no greater meaning than just simply doing them? What if what we feel in those little moments we want to escape and place in the context of a greater meaning is the meaning itself? If healing is just acknowledging pain, then maybe living is just acknowledging life. There are so many anxieties and frustrations and terrible things that cease instantly when we just say them out loud. The point of learning to grieve and mourn and be present is only so we can just be aware. Recognition is the remedy. It's the only thing we're really supposed to do. And the real suffering, the inescapable kind, comes from avoiding what's in front of us. It follows and haunts us until we acknowledge it and are okay with it, even if it doesn't make us happy, even if we're anything but. A soul wants a body so it can experience things, and that body will fight itself until it makes itself aware, until it does what it was programmed to do, until it takes what it needs to take and feels what it wants to feel, no matter how dark that seems. We're not supposed to be better than our humanness. Doing so is overlooking the point of the body in the first place. We can choose happiness, but we choose the full spectrum of experience instead. Maybe instead of believing things are linear and the road only goes upward and toward happiness, we allow ourselves what we choose. We pay bills and do dishes and cook dinner and wonder why. Maybe there's no point to feeling other than to feel it. Maybe it just persists because we pretend there is. 54. The importance of stillness. Why it's imperative to make time to do nothing. We're conditioned to associate stillness with inactivity and inactivity with failure. We're trained to be overworked and to believe that if at any point we aren't doing something that contributes to our goals, we're not doing anything. It makes us unable to just be with ourselves. Our purpose only legitimate if it's serving someone or something else. In fact, we are so opposed to being with ourselves. In a study done by the University of Virginia, over 700 people were asked to just sit in a room alone with their thoughts for 6 to 15 minutes, alongside a shock button that they could press if they ever wanted out. 67% of men and 25% of women chose to shock themselves rather than sit quietly and think. Stillness is psychologically imperative, though. We are not built to be running all the time, and doing so leads to absolutely detrimental effects, the least of which I will touch on here. When overworking is our identity, we lose track of who we actually are, and in the process, we stop living actual lives. 1. What we call doing nothing is actually crucial for our physiological selves and is essential to maintain a happy, peaceful, balanced lifestyle. The idea that we must always be doing something is completely cultural and completely unhealthy. Notice how we only feel we are doing something when that something can be externally measured by other people. 2. In the do-nothing state, the brain is superpowering itself. It's completing unconscious tasks or integrating and processing conscious experiences. In the resting state, neural networks can process experiences, consolidate memories, reinforce learning, regular attention and emotions, and in turn keep us more productive and effective in our day-to-day work. 3. Human beings are not designed to be continually expending energy whilst conscious, and it has a massive effect on the very thing they're trying to put their energy toward, their work. Tony Schwartz cited a study in his piece on productivity and restfulness in the New York Times, which proved that not getting enough sleep or do-nothing time was the highest predictor of on-the-job burnout. Another Harvard study he cited estimated that sleep deprivation costs American companies $63.2 billion a year in lost productivity. 4. When you do not sit and allow yourself to reflect, reconcile, and acknowledge what you feel, you actively give said feelings more power. Stephanie Brown argues, there's this widespread belief that thinking and feeling will only slow you down and get in your way, but it's the opposite. Most psychotherapists would contend that suppressing negative feelings only gives them more power, leading to intrusive thoughts, which can prompt people to be even busier to avoid them. 5. Creativity thrives in stillness and nothingness. Creativity is fostered in the state of stepping away from the project, task, or issue at hand, and distracting oneself with other day-to-day tasks. Countless studies show that people who are deeply creative on a consistent basis